This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I went to a lecture this morning about how to develop resilience in kids, and it was kind of good. I'm just over it, to be honest. Everyone's talking about resilience because I think we're reacting to having raised a generation of kids, you know, who get like a trophy for everything. Resilience is important for sure, but what do you really want for your kids? If you ask a bunch of people, they say, we want our kids to be happy, but like in a mentally healthy way. And there's nothing wrong with that. What I see parents doing in my clinic way too often is trying to make their kids happy in the moment. And yes, of course, there is joy in getting a piece of candy or making a trip to Disney, but it's not this hedonistic definition of happiness that we're after for our kids in the long run. Like for any person, child or adult, if they have constant fun and happy experiences, they aren't happy. There are all these studies of people who win the lottery, and the end result is they aren't happier. In fact, I think some of them are less happy. What do we really mean when we say we want our kids to be happy? Happiness is an emotion. You can't wish an emotion on a person. So when parents say they want their kids to be happy, what they really mean is they want their kids to have the happiness that comes from life satisfaction and well-being. How do you help your kids grow up to find this? I'm going to tell you. As a parent, you're already the family cook, fashion consultant, driver, schedule manager, activity consultant, and now you are also your family's wellness coach. On today's show, I'm going to tell you the 7 tips for raising a happy kid. Dr. Wendy Hunter, and I'm the pediatrician next door. I'm that doctor friend you call for practical advice about your kids' health. I mix the science of medicine with the reality of parenting. Should you really care if you raise a happy kid? Maybe you should focus more on raising a smart kid or a kind kid or one who will be financially successful and host you on their yacht when you retire. The answer is yes. Absolutely, you should want to raise a happy kid. I mean, it feels good to be happy. But also, happiness is linked to improved health, living longer, more job satisfaction, and a good marriage. There are tons and tons of studies that show that happier people are healthier in every aspect of life. Most psychologists believe happiness is something that needs to be worked at. I mean, of course they think this. Their livelihood literally depends on people believing they need to put effort into being happy, and obviously therapy is part of that. And I agree, we do need to work at it. Just like you have to exercise your muscles to keep them strong, you have to work at happiness. You can't just go to the gym once and expect to have physical fitness, and social fitness works the same way, and I'm gonna get to that. What makes a person happy? Think about this for a second. What makes you happy? Friendships? Feeling like you make a difference in the world? Hobbies? Your kids? Your family? Whatever things you just thought of that help you to be happy, I want you to keep those in mind because those are the things that you want to cultivate in your own children. You can't keep giving them a lollipop every 15 minutes and think you can keep them happy forever. So just like you taught your kids to sleep through the night, and I hope you have done that, and if you haven't, go back and listen to my episodes about sleep, and the way you taught them skills like riding a bike, you teach your kids to be happy. But here's the crazy part. What percent of your happiness do you create? At least 30 to 40% of your happiness is genetically determined. Some studies put the effects of genes on happiness as high as 50%. If you go back, the first studies of happiness were in twins. Researchers found that identical twins with identical genes who are raised in different homes are more similar in their happiness than non-identical twins who are raised together. This was the first evidence that genes play a role in our happiness. Once there were a whole bunch of these studies, reviews of all the studies put together had similar findings. They found overall about 50% of happiness is determined by genetics. If that seems like a lot, compare this to IQ. That's thought to be about 80% genetic. We don't know which genes exactly determine this, but you can imagine that things like the effects of sunlight on an individual or how happy a person's face naturally looks at rest, those can have an effect on their happiness. And there are studies that show that there are promoter regions on genes that increase neurotransmitters that are related to your feelings. Basically, there is an inherited component of happiness, and one way to think about it is that genes are the architecture of a person's personality. It's the architecture because 10% of happiness in studies is shown to be built by life circumstances. Only 10%. And the other 40%, that's under your control. So just because your sense of well-being is in your genes doesn't mean if your child wasn't born with happy genes, they're not going to be happy. There are factors that are under your child's control, and you can foster those. The most important determinant of happiness is probably our connection to other people. And I'm going to talk about how to foster that, as well as developing rituals, mind tricks, and even food that increases happiness at every age. One thing to keep in mind is that happiness in a baby is different from that in an older child or teen. You have to have different skills as a parent at each of these stages. In a baby, things like a big surprise or literally your face make a child happy. They can be happy just through having their basic needs met. I mean, think about it. If you have poop on your bottom, how much joy can you derive from the poop being gone? Like a lot. And what about a nice nap? Naps are joy-inducing at pretty much any age, especially the ones when you wake up and you're drooling. You know what I mean. To cultivate happiness in a teenager, on the other hand, this may still be achieved by meeting their basic needs. Their needs aren't to be held or fed like a baby. Well, actually, it might be to be fed. So be sure to have lots of snacks around. Their needs as a teenager are to be understood, listened to, and supported. My tips to raise a healthy kid work at every age, including your own. Much of what is known about happiness comes from the Harvard Study of Adult Development. This is a fascinating program. The study recruited a group of teenagers way back in 1938, and it followed them through their life, and it's still following their children. It's known as the world's longest scientific study of happiness. The study is currently directed by Dr. Robert Waldinger, who is the fourth director of the program. Yes, this study has outlived three career spans already. The study has revealed many understandings of health factors across a person's lifetime because it followed its subjects for so long. But one of the most interesting findings started to reveal itself not until the 1980s, and that was that our connection to other people is highly related to happiness. This was very surprising to the researchers. So this is the first tip: cultivate connection. Close friendships are important, but even connecting with the same checkout person at the grocery store or having a connection with your favorite barista, even chatting with a stranger on a train, have been shown in various studies to enhance well-being. So I want you to look for ways you can help your kids to connect. This is easy when they're young. They make friends on the playground with every new kid. If you have a child who is more shy, look for activities they can do where they interact with other kids. I actually really worry about older kids when they're in organized sports. They are pushed and they're doing drills and it's also serious. These teenagers need unstructured time to goof off, to screw around, and just to hang out. They need to have experiences with each other that aren't dictated by an adult in order for them to really connect and develop long-term friendships. It starts with play dates with young kids, but don't lose those play dates as kids get older. Take a group out to go bowling or hiking. Set up crafts or an art time at your house. Encourage your kids to do baking projects with a few close friends. Make time and space to develop relationships. Who do you have in your life right now that you connect to? Ask yourself this question. If you were sick or scared at 2 o'clock in the morning, who could you call to help you? Ask your child this question and see what they say. If you have just one person you can call, that's fantastic. But if you only have one person, maybe it's time to reach out and connect with someone you haven't been in touch with in a while. We need our community, not just when things are hard, but to keep things great. When something bad happens, you know how you go into fight or flight mode? Kids do too. And we know this means a surge of stress hormones. And we know that when we have a person we can go to, they calm that surge. Make it a point to help your kids see the importance of reaching out to others when things are hard. And let them see you do this too. Think of the most difficult things you faced in your life. It might have been bringing home your babies, and those times were easier because you had someone to support you, right? Tell your kids this. This is the idea that other people are important for supporting us. In the Harvard study, the healthiest people in their 80s were those who had meaningful, healthy relationships when they were just 50 years old, and they cultivated those friendships. So put effort into creating and maintaining friendships when you're raising your kids. And let your kids see you make plans to take a walk with a friend. Share with your kids when you went to a dinner with a friend or take cookies to a neighbor together. Make connections part of your family culture. One of my fitness instructors taught me to think of our friends like surge protectors. When things get tough, who do you plug into to make things smoother? Who are your surge protectors? Who buffers life for your kids when it gets tough? Who are their surge protectors? At the same time, it's okay to share with your kids when you have a tough time with a relationship. Your kids are going to learn very young that friendships are not always easy, but like anything else, it's a muscle you strengthen through practice. So tell your kids about when you had a difficult situation with a friend and talk about how you repaired that. A good life is not free from challenges. That's part of what makes a good life. I said I had 7 tips to raise a happy child. The first was to cultivate connection for yourself as a role model and for your kids to cultivate connection to others. The second tip is to model being curious about another's state of mind. It makes people feel really good when you show genuine interest in them, and this is a good habit to develop in your children. It's an interesting thing to work on as parents. When our kids are babies, you know how we watch them intently when they smile and we're so encouraged when our toddlers reach new milestones? But we don't pay that much attention as kids get older. The truth is that a middle school kid's brain develops more rapidly than at any other age other than that age of 0 to 3. But we don't really pay attention, like, for example, to our 6th graders' meltdowns. You got to continue to be curious about your child's behaviors, even in the teen years. And teach your kids to be curious. Here's how. Okay, your 7th grader, he comes home and he talks about a kid being mean at school. Listen to the story. And then I want you to ask questions from a curious mindset. I know you want to try to fix the problem, but do this instead. Ask things like, why do you think he did that? What else do you think might be going on with him? How do you think he feels after he did that? When you encourage curiosity like this, it helps your child to start thinking that way in the moment when they witness something that's hard. So if a child directly says something mean to your kid, they are trained not to think, oh, poor me, I'm a victim. But instead, they're going to go into that curious mindset and think, why is Sam calling me a loser? It takes time to develop this. I mean, I can't even do it. So I am telling you to try it, and I don't know what I could do myself. Anyway, the third tip is to let your kids meet challenges but with your support, not with your intervention. What I mean by this is don't fix things for your kid. And try to catch yourself when you are intervening in a situation that avoids your child having something difficult happen. So say you're at a pizza restaurant and your kid needs a straw. Tell your kid to go up by themselves to the counter and ask for one. Don't do it for them. Here's another example. If they don't get on the sports team they were hoping for, let them deal with it themselves, but be there with a sympathetic ear and ask, what things could you do when faced with a challenge like this? That helps them start to develop creative solutions to problems. That way they feel self-reliance and powerful to help themselves, and that breeds well-being. Think of it like this. Life is full of waves. You can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. We want our kids to surf. The fourth tip is to create rituals and routines. Research into happiness shows that among the happiest people, they have in common that they have strong family connections. Even teenagers, if they're trying to disconnect from the family, they really do still want to be connected. There's this book that summarizes this concept, and I love the title. It's called Get Out of My Life, But First, Could You Drive Me and Cheryl to the Mall? Check it out if that speaks to you. Teenagers may want you gone away from them, but they also want their family at the same time. And the best way to do this is through rituals. We know that regular family dinners correlate with higher grade point average, greater self-confidence, and lower rates of substance use and depression in teens. It's normal for teens to resist your routines, like your rituals around holidays or going to church, but routines create a structure that helps them get through the harder times. You don't have to be rigid and force them to go to every meal. Like in our home, we have aperitivo every Friday night, and sometimes it's as late as 8:30 because that's when everyone is available, but it's a ritual and nobody in our family skips it. They know it's happening every week. We don't have any screens on. We sit around the cocktail table with a fancy drink and lots of appetizers, and we reconnect. Maybe you should call or visit grandma every Thursday night or have game night. Identify rituals that you may already be doing and formalize those. Make them a pattern and a habit. The fifth tip for happiness is to volunteer or be charitable. Doing something for others takes the focus off yourself. The first studies looking at volunteering and happiness, they were criticized because they were said to not account for the fact that maybe happy people were volunteering more than unhappy people. And the researchers weren't actually measuring whether the act of volunteering increases happiness. But recent studies have accounted for this. And yes, it's true. Volunteering in your community increases your happiness. And so does charitable giving. Besides that, it has the added benefit that kids need to figure out what they hate doing and what they love doing in order that they may someday find a career. There's no better way to get free exposure with limited commitment than to volunteer. Just do an internet search for volunteer opportunities, kids, and the name of your city. And if you can't do that, try something like baking cookies for your neighbors and deliver them together. Or buy cheap flower bouquets, rearrange them, and decorate them yourself with ribbons and bring them to a retirement home or to your neighbors. This doesn't have to be a formal volunteer experience. It does have more benefit, though, if your child does the volunteering willingly, as opposed to, say, like court-ordered or just volunteering with their school because the school organized the activity and they just have to show up. I'm sure that you can attest to the feeling of satisfaction that comes from giving to others. It's thought to be because your brain releases feel-good chemicals like dopamine and endorphins. Dopamine is the reward neurotransmitter that's associated with pleasure and motivation. And endorphins are natural painkillers. They reduce stress and anxiety. Not only does volunteering trigger these chemicals and enhance happiness and boost your mood, volunteering has actually been shown in research to lower your blood pressure, enhance immune function, and of course, it expands your social connections, which you already know enhances your happiness. Volunteering is a shortcut to happiness. You're always going to get more than you give. There's one other way to boost your mood through the action of neurotransmitters, and that's by our food choices. And that's tip number 6. What you eat determines what bacteria you have in your intestines. Gut bacteria produce byproducts from their own metabolism, and those byproducts affect what's absorbed in your intestines, and they regulate neurotransmitters in the gut that have a direct effect on the brain. It's called the gut-brain connection. You can increase the feel-good neurotransmitters, serotonin and dopamine, by what you eat. It has been observed that vegetarians have a lower rate of depression. So scientists compared a group of 39 meat eaters and divided them into 3 experimental diets. One group was vegetarian, one was pescatarian, and one ate no meat and no fish. The mood of the group who ate meat didn't change at all during the study. Their mood stayed exactly the same. But the mood scores of the vegetarians improved after just 2 weeks on the diet. The researchers were surprised that the fish-only group didn't change, but this was a small study, so who knows? The reason that researchers think meat affects mood is because meat has a fatty acid called arachidonic acid, which is known to change the brain in a way that can disturb mood. There are 2 fats that oppose the effects of arachidonic acid, and those are eicosapentaenoic acid and docosahexaenoic acid. You may have seen these referred to as EPA and DHA. That's why the scientists expected fish to improve mood. There's more to come on this, but reducing your meat intake, it might make you happier. We also know that eating more fruit and vegetables improves mood. In studies, fruit tended to help more than vegetables. This information comes from a study of 25,000 people, so this is a pretty good bet that this is true. People in the study who ate the least amount of fruit and veggies were 80% more likely to have depressive symptoms. That means that if you teach your kids to like fruits and veggies and to include them in their diet when they aren't with you, as they grow older, this choice will help them protect against depression. There are a few other diet mood studies that are compelling, and I'll put the links in the show notes. Overall, these studies show that a vegan or vegetarian diet is protective, and diets with high sugar, high fat, and processed foods are associated with inflammation and a higher risk of depression. I'm sure this is not surprising to you at all. My favorite study shows that a high polyphenol diet improves well-being. And what has polyphenols? Red wine, tea, coffee, and dark chocolate. I mean, also fruits, nuts, and seeds, but let's focus on that red wine, tea, and dark chocolate. This study showed that people who ate 6 portions of fruit and vegetables that included some berries, and they had some dark chocolate every day for 8 weeks, had better general mental health and less depression. I bet you have a better sense of well-being just hearing about this. Okay, speaking of hearing good things, that's the last tip. Tip number 7 is what we tell ourselves. That affects our happiness. Yeah, I know. If you're like me, meditation is, you know, supposed to be good for mindfulness or whatever, but I cannot meditate. I can't make the time. I can't commit. I don't like it. Anyway, I'm going to give you a shortcut. There is a specific technique called loving kindness meditation, or LKM. And research has shown that loving kindness meditation activates the brain areas that are involved in emotional processing and empathy, and it boosts a sense of positivity. More importantly to me, it's easy to make this part of your child's bedtime, and it's a very concrete thing to do. I mean, I need a checklist or specific directions to do something like this. I just cannot just meditate. Okay, all you do is take less than a minute to send kind wishes to yourself or another person. It's easy. You just repeat these 3 or 4 positive phrases. Okay, these are the ones most people say. They say, "May I be happy. May I feel safe and loved. May I be healthy and strong." That's it. Your child can say it to themselves by saying their name specifically, like, "May Wendy feel safe and loved. May Wendy be healthy and strong." Or they can say it to a friend. And eventually, and more powerfully, they can say it to someone that they don't like. If your child is having a tough time with another kid, explain that kids who aren't kind are that way because they have someone in their life that isn't kind to them. I've read a number of cases when a child has a bully, for example. Say it's a kid named Victor, and he is calling your kid ugly or a troll, or Victor's saying that your kid's hair is ugly and he can't play with him. After your child has some experience with LKM, they can practice by sending good vibes to Victor. May Victor be happy. May Victor feel safe and loved, and so on. This helps to recognize that other people have the same needs that you do, that kindness is stronger than anger, and eventually you will associate positive feelings with the bully. One other tip to help include this in your bedtime routine is to check out this book called May All People and Pigs Be Happy, and read this book before you guide your child through a quick LKM practice at bedtime. If you already incorporate prayer before bed, this may already be part of your routine and you didn't even know what a great thing you were doing. I have a hard time with mindfulness. I don't really get it, but it made me feel better to find this one area of happiness research. There are studies that show that thinking positive thoughts does nothing to make you happier. You can't bully your brain into being happy. However, focusing and thinking about the present moment does increase happiness. You see, humans did not evolve to be happy. People who survived to have babies, those were the ones who were anxious and vigilant, and they avoided being eaten by a lion. Humans are wired for survival. Evolutionary pressure did not select for happy humans. In fact, we have a negativity bias. Our brains look around for what might get in the way of our survival. And when something scary happens, like being bullied or falling on the playground, a structure in your brain called the amygdala takes all the blood and oxygen, and your automatic defenses take over. This is why we have to train our kids' brains to react in ways that calm that automatic biologic reaction. And we can do that by cultivating connections, curiosity, practicing meeting challenges, having rituals, volunteering, eating the right foods, and practicing mindfulness. I just told you a bunch of stuff to do to pursue happiness. But at the same time, don't chase happiness, because chasing happiness can have the inadvertent effect of chasing it away. Several studies of people intending to be happy and working on their happiness have shown that their pursuit has the opposite effect. Researchers think this is because of expectation. Our expectations are just too high. What about checking in on how happy your child is? You have to be careful when you ask if they're happy. This implies to them that happiness is very important. And when people check in on how happy they are, they commonly find they're not as happy as they hoped they would be. The warning here is, don't ask your child if they're happy. There are tons of other tips for cultivating happiness, like letting go of being perfect, getting physical exercise, and spending time in nature. They all help to boost happiness. There's one more thing I do to be happy and to help my family be happy. Actually, the truth is that I do this more at work than I do at home. My family tends to see my tired, grouchy energy. Here's what I do. I remind myself that my mood affects the room I'm in. We all have nervous system structures called mirror neurons. We absorb the energy around us. And when you enter a room with a happy disposition, everyone feels it. And when you complain and you're a negative Nelly, everyone feels that too. It's the same reason that you can't help but smile back when someone smiles at you. Try it. Look at someone, tell them to try not to smile, and then look at them and smile and laugh with joy. I bet they can't help but smile back. For more from the Pediatrician Next Door, find me on the web at pediatriciannextdoorpodcast.com. If you've got a question about the weird things kids do, send an email to hello@pediatriciannextdoorpodcast.com for a chance to hear your voice on the show. I'm Dr. Wendy Hunter, and I'm the Pediatrician Next Door. This show is produced by Red Rock Music. Make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever it is you're listening. I'll be back next time with more.